Welcome to the Center for Lit Academy Library. This discussion of The Devil's Arithmetic by Jane Yolen is a part of the Junior High Literature Series.
By way of introduction to our story today, as Mr. Andrews said, Jane Yolen is a currently living author. She was born in 1939, so she's getting to be, she's in her 70s. A wonderful woman, has written several great books. I actually knew her as a picture book author before I found out about this story, this chapter book. But she's very talented, as I'm sure you saw. A very gripping story. She is known as the Hans Christian Andersen of America. She's been called that by several publications. She's written over 280 stories, so she's very prolific.
Wow.
Yeah. She herself is of Jewish heritage, so this story is something that is close to her heart. Not quite biographical, but she has, she says that she has taken some of the stories from experiences that have been handed down as stories in her own family, in their memory. So, some interesting facts about Jane Yolen.
So this is not an autobiography from her, but something similar in terms of her family history. Good. So, let's get started with our discussion today. Mrs. Andrews, what's the best way to tackle a book like this? Some heavy content in here, isn't there?
There is. But I think it was very beautifully treated.
Yeah, I thought so as well. So the first thing that I'd like to do, I think, is get a list of our characters together, and by way of getting a setting for the story, talk a little bit about those characters and the kind of people that they are, particularly in that first scene of the book with the Passover Seder. What do we know about the family that we are being introduced to in that opening scene? Does anybody know?
Caleb, your hand is raised. Go ahead.
We know that some of the older people were in the concentration camps because the old man, whose name I have already forgotten, had, like, the old man who was yelling at the television, I think, had, like, numbers on his arm.
Okay, good. Great. So that's Grandpa Will. And we know that her family, some of her family members, have survived the Holocaust.
So can we get a list of the characters together, Mrs. Andrews?
Do we want to do characters first or setting?
Well, I think they're all sort of wrapped up together, don't you?
Okay.
So we've got Grandpa Will. We've got Aunt Eva. We've got Hannah herself. Her little brother. Is it Aaron? I think it's Aaron.
It is Aaron.
So as Caleb mentioned, the older members of this family are actual Holocaust survivors, which we know based on the presence of a tattoo on the inner arm of Grandpa Will. And we're going to discuss a scene in which that tattoo plays pretty prominently here in just a minute.
James reminds us that Hannah's name in the second part of the story is Haya.
That's right.
Or life.
And it's almost two characters, isn't it? In some senses, it's two characters. I mean, we're introduced to Hannah first, and then she sort of becomes Haya. But then there's also a sense in which she sort of forgets her life in New Rochelle as Hannah at a certain point, which is paradoxically the whole point of her remembering in the first place. So I think it might be worthwhile to treat those two characters as different things, or maybe as two different stages of our introduction to Hannah.
And in that second life, she has Gittel and Shmuel. And then there are the girls, right? There's Rivka, and then the other girls, Shifra, Yenel, Esther, Rachel.
Good. So as Caleb mentioned, there are Holocaust survivors in the room here. What is the scene that we're introduced to? What's the first scene of the story where we meet Hannah and meet the rest of her family? What is it that the family is engaged in that scene?
Madeline, go ahead.
She is with her family at Passover. Well, when it first starts, she's driving with her family to Passover. But then they're there, and she doesn't want to be there.
Good. Why doesn't she want to be there?
Well, none of her other friends really celebrate Passover, and she thinks it's boring, and she'd rather be out doing more fun stuff.
Good.
Good. So she's sort of opposed to this whole thing in her head. Maybe not because she understands, but perhaps because she doesn't understand why we're doing this, right? And then also she mentions, it's not fair that none of the other kids that I'm friends with, none of the other people I know have to do this, to show up to this boring dinner. Can anybody describe to me what this dinner is really about? What is Passover? Does anybody know?
Lauren, go ahead.
Passover is the meal that the Jews celebrated when the death angel passed over their houses in Egypt.
Good.
Good. Yeah, the angel of death. What are they called in the book? The Malach Hamavi, is that right? Let's see here. See if I can find that section. So yeah, it's a commemoration. It's a feast or a festival during which the Jewish culture commemorates the Bible story where the angel of death passed over the houses of all of the Jews in Egypt when they were all the Hebrews in Egypt when they were slaves of the Pharaoh, right? It's one of the plagues. And the Lord told them to spread the blood of a lamb on the lintels and on the doorpost of their houses, right? And the angel of death, as he's sweeping through the Egyptian capital to find all of the firstborns and kill them, would pass over those particular houses. So the Passover is essentially a feast of remembering. A feast of remembering. I want to put that phrase in your minds and have you guys think about that as we go through this class. The book opens, the story opens on a feast of remembering, and specifically what's being remembered is the angel of death passing over the homes of the Hebrews, sparing their children. Right, so they're celebrating the Passover, and they are, in so doing, remembering God, the angel of death, passing over them and sparing their children.
And not just sparing their children, but also that as a tool, the reason that these plagues took place, the reason that the angel of death slaughtered the firstborn children of the Egyptians was a means to liberating the Jews who were in bondage, the Israelites who were in bondage to the Egyptians. Another incidence of Jewish bondage, which we see again in this story.
Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of a paradoxical thing, right? If we think about it for a second, this death, right, the angel of death sweeping over and killing people is the mechanism for freedom. And it's Malach Hamavis is what it is. I just looked it up. I found it. Malach Hamavis, the angel of death. Good. So what about this Seder? What do we know about? What's the atmosphere of that scene in the beginning of the story? We know that Hannah doesn't really want to be there, right? Because she'd rather be at the mall with her buddies or hanging out with her friends, right? What's the atmosphere of the rest of the family? How's everybody feeling? What can you tell us about that scene sort of emotionally?
Caleb, your hand is up. You may need to unmute yourself on your end. Oh. Nope. Okay. Madeline, how about you?
Oh, sorry. I didn't hear what you said.
Mr. Andrews asked what the mood of the Passover feast is. What is the family like?
They're kind of all like really sober.
Okay, and so it's about- kind of serious. Did you have something else?
Oh, no, ma'am.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so we have kind of a serious atmosphere, which kind of is part of the thing that's bothering Hannah, right? Her friends are all having fun with Easter egg hunts and chocolate. Her family is kind of sad and a little crazy, especially Grandpa Will.
Sad and a little crazy. Yeah. What's Grandpa Will doing in this scene? Do you guys remember what happens with Grandpa Will?
Evelyn, go ahead.
He starts yelling at the TV.
Yeah.
Kind of freaking out.
That's good. Why? Do you remember why? Can you describe that for us?
I don't really remember why.
Okay. Anybody else? Anybody else remember why he's yelling at the screen? Evelyn's right. He goes a little crazy, kind of loses his marbles just a little bit, and starts yelling and screaming and holding his fist up in the air, saying, "I'll give them this." Remember that? Who is it that he's yelling at?
Daniel. Do you know?
He was yelling at the pictures that were on the TV of concentration camps, corpses.
Yeah. Good. Okay, so he does not have a very good reaction to these images from his past. Daniel, do you remember what... Hannah has a particular memory of Grandpa Will. She tried to impress him in a certain way, and it didn't go so well. Do you remember that?
Yeah, she like tried to make a tattoo like that matched his numbers.
Yeah, and how did he respond?
He started screaming, I think.
Good. Yeah, so thank you. Hannah's experiences with Grandpa Will are not her favorite. In fact, he starts screaming Malkamavis at her, right? Angel of Death.
Angel of Death. Angel of Death.
So that's Grandpa Will. I'll jump down to characters and we'll kind of describe him. But Aunt Eva has these numbers too, right?
She's also got a string of numbers on the inside of her left arm, signifying that she too is a Holocaust survivor. But her attitude, the atmosphere of her character, is a little bit different, isn't it? What kind of a relationship do Hannah and Aunt Eva have?
Lauren, go ahead.
Well, Aunt Eva is her like favorite aunt, and she lets Hannah like do things, other things with her.
Yeah, good. Okay, so she's her favorite aunt. They get along really well, and the reason Hannah enjoys hanging out with her, like Lauren said, is that it's Aunt Eva doesn't really talk about the Holocaust in the same way that Grandpa Will does. She's not fixated on it.
Yeah, there's a lack of bitterness, I think. She doesn't seem as bitter to me as Grandpa Will does. And I think we're going to know more. We're going to understand more about that as we go along through the story. But it's interesting to note the difference between those two, between Grandpa Will and Aunt Eva, as we start our discussion here. Because they're both, clearly, because of this tattoo on their arms, they're both have similar life content. And one of them has responded by losing his marbles and being angry and bitter and completely scarred by this experience. But Aunt Eva seems to be at peace and seems to be relatively happy. And we can tell that she has offered many times to explain to Hannah what happened and to explain the Holocaust in all of its detail and in all of its horror. But it seems to us that there's a protection there, that Hannah hasn't been allowed to hear some of those details for quite some time. And that's sort of what we find out by the end of the story.
Emma, your hand is up. Did you have something you'd like to add?
I just wanted to say that Hannah was also named after a friend of Aunt Eva's.
Yeah. What do you, that's good. That's a good thing to bring up. What friend was that? Does she know? Or at least at the beginning of the story. At the beginning of the story, what does Hannah know about who she was named after?
She just knew that it was a friend and she died.
Okay, good.
Right, a dead friend, she says. I was named after some friend of Aunt Eva's. A dead friend.
Yeah. Good. Thank you, Emma. That's important. So let's add... Okay, good. So they're at this feast, and this we can kind of put in our exposition bubble, right? We've opened up on this Seder feast, and Hannah, how does she, I mean, we talked a little bit about how she's frustrated at being here, but what is her reaction to all of these traditions, in particular, in contrast with her brother Aaron? How does she feel about all these different things that they have to do? All the different.
I remember, pick me.
Go ahead.
Well, the picture we get of Hannah at the beginning of the story is of a petulant little child, I think. Either that or of a little girl who is who's playing up, who thinks that she's too old for all the things going on. Her attitude towards the traditions that are involved in the Passover Seder. Her attitude towards those is that she's too cool for them, that she's grown up to be older than all of these traditions, and that maybe it's fine for Aaron, who's still excited to find that, oh, I think it's spelled Afikoman or something like that. I don't have any idea how to pronounce any of the Yiddish words in this book. But to find that blanket that Grandpa Will always hides easily under his chair, and then Aaron's job is to find it and run around the house with it, right? She thinks she's too old for that, and so she sort of is condescending towards Aaron over the topic of that whole tradition. So Hannah is young, I think, and immature. But one of the ways to figure out what we're seeing from Hannah at the beginning of this story, and I think what I'd like to do in class today is ask this question way more often than we usually do. At every juncture, in every scene, as we move along through the story, I want to ask, what does Hannah want? Because this is a story about Hannah changing in some fundamental ways. This experience that she has changes her. She becomes a different kind of person with a different set of character traits by the end of the story. It's a coming of age narrative, I think. And so we're going to be able to learn a lot about the thematic content of the story if we ask ourselves at every section, what does Hannah want? What does she want now? What does she want in this scene? How is it different from what she wanted the last scene? So in this first scene, what I would say, I'll just open up our what does she want discussion. In this scene, I would say what Hannah wants is to leave. She wants to get out of here. This whole Passover thing, she's past it. She's over it. She doesn't want to be in there anymore. She just wants to leave. You guys agree with that? What do you think about that?
Emma, your hand is up.
Can you ask the question again?
Mr. Andrews asked, what is it that Hannah wants at this point in the story?
She wants them to stop worrying about the past and just look forward to what's going on at the moment and what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put that. In fact,
yeah, would you say that one more time? Actually, that's awesome.
She wants them to stop worrying about what happened in the past and to forget all that and look forward to the future and what's happening at that time.
Very good. I like that. Because that reminds me of the thing that she says at the beginning of the story when she says, I don't want to remember. It's one of the first lines of the book. And the implications of that, that I think Emma put really well, is that she would really rather focus on the present and forget.
Yes, exactly. She wants to live in the now, in this obsession with the past and what happened in the past. She doesn't understand it. It's beyond her maturity to understand why her relatives are so obsessed with the past. She wants them to think about the present and the future instead of the past. Good. So what kind of a conflict is that here in the beginning of the story?
Well, I guess I would say the question of remembering is kind of a personal question. She would rather not remember. Sounds like the beginning of a man versus self conflict to me.
Yeah, I think so too. Okay, so let's take a quick detour, just a brief detour here. Remember, we were talking about the Passover. We were talking about that feast and what it's remembering, right? It's remembering the deliverance of the Hebrews out of Egypt, out of slavery, right? Specifically via the mechanism of the angel of death, who's a messenger of God, coming down and visiting destruction and death on all of the captors, all the Egyptians. So this is a tradition and a story that is central to Hebrew culture, central to Jewish culture. They live by remembering in a lot of ways. Their whole tradition is built around the story of the Israelites, right? The story of the Hebrews, the history that they have of being the people of God in a nation that God has dealt with closely over the centuries. And so in celebrating this Passover, one of the things that Yolen is pointing out to us is that this family is absolutely steeped and bathed in tradition. It's the fabric of their relationships with each other. And indeed, that's true, like I just said, of all Jewish culture. So in saying, I don't want to remember, that's not just a statement about Hannah's personality in that moment or her maturity level. It's also an identity question, right? Grandpa Will and Aunt Eva, in different ways, are taking their identity from their memory, taking their identity from their remembering. And Hannah's basically saying, that's not who I am. I don't want to remember, right? I don't want these things to identify me. So I think Mrs. Andrews is right. I think the question that's being asked here is, who am I? Who is Hannah? And that's very much a man versus self sort of question, right? I don't want to remember. I don't want my life to be defined in the same way that my family's life is defined by my cultural heritage, by the past, by the memory of the Holocaust. So I think you're right, Mrs. Andrews. I think it's a man versus self conflict.
Well, and this question of who is Hannah takes a little more practical turn here in a second, right? Because she literally is not going to be able to remember who she is. Where does the action start rising?
Yeah, what's our first moment of rising action? Let's get into the plot of this story.
They're all at this Passover feast.
What happens with Hannah and Grandpa Will in this particular minute? Hannah does something that causes him to offer her a great honor from his perspective. And whether she thinks of it as one or not, it is an honor. What is that?
Madeline, go ahead.
She gives up all of her wine instead of just some of it. Yeah. And he thought she was doing it out of capacity when really she wasn't. She just didn't want the rest of it. And so he let her open the door. But when she opened the door, she was transported into the past, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. And James, can you tell me a little bit about why does Hannah open the door? What tradition is that?
It's the tradition where after Passover you open the door to the prophet of Elijah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Did you have why the prophet Elijah? Why are you letting him in?
I'm not sure, actually.
That is perfectly okay. Thank you, James. The reason they open the door to Elijah, it's a sign of hope, right? In the midst of them remembering this night of suffering, this night of being passed over, this night of bondage, and the days before the release from the Egyptians, there's also the prophet Elijah as a sign of redemption, right? Opening the door, leaving him room to come in. So it's interesting to me that Hannah is given this honor by Grandpa Will, and as Madeline said, it was supposed to be an honoring of her unselfishness, but actually she didn't really intend that at all.
Right, which is interesting, but think about that for just a second, right? What's being honored is selflessness. Is that sort of a foreshadowing, do you think? Remember, foreshadowing, we've talked about this together before. Foreshadowing is an element of the story where an author drops us a hint about what's going to happen later. And usually, he or she does so in a place where the content of the plot in that particular moment is important, right? It's something that we need to remember and think about, right? So here, I think what he's done is given us a hint about the kind of character trait, selflessness, that is going to be exalted and pointed out throughout the story. And he's done so at a particular moment, a moment having to do with salvation, a moment having to do with, because of their remembering, because of their adherence to tradition and their deep understanding of where they fit personally in this tradition of being the Lord's people, right? In that particular moment, what's being emphasized is salvation. They're opening the door expectantly. As a people, they're opening the door to salvation and letting the figure of salvation in.
But instead of salvation coming in this moment when she opens the door, she enters a world of suffering. Let's jump back to our setting. Where does the second part of the story take place? Where has she gone when she opens the door? James, go ahead.
Sorry, the internet just dropped out for a little there.
Oh, that's okay. Do you still want to answer the question, or do you want us to choose someone else?
Which question?
Where does... give us a description of the setting where Hannah goes in the second half of the story.
She goes back into the past, to the beginning of World War II and the Holocaust, to her relative's house.
Okay, good.
I think it's Grandpa Will's house. And she tries to warn them when they see the trucks about the Nazis and the Holocaust. But they believe that they're actually trying to help and getting them out of the war zone.
Very good. Okay, thanks, James. Let's unpack that a little bit. There's a lot of good information there. So she steps through the door, and she finds herself in what, as James said, is during the time of World War II and the Holocaust. But she doesn't know this yet. She just finds herself in a village shack. Everything looks a little bit older and a little different, and she's very confused by this.
Now, as you would be, being transported to somewhere dramatically different from where you were standing a second ago, right?
Right. It isn't quite Grandpa Will's house, although Grandpa Will is going to factor into this whole narrative, but she is instead in the house of Gittel and Shmuel, who are not Hannah of the New Rochelle world's relatives, but this is, remember, Aunt Eva's friend Chaya, her relatives, her aunt and uncle. Yes, Lauren, good. She is in Poland.
And it's in a village, as Caleb says. It's in a small place. So remember how a second ago we were talking about the question of this whole story is a question of remembering, which is, for the Hebrew people in particular, a question of identity, right? The question that Hannah is sort of beating around when she shows up in the beginning of the story at the Seder is, who am I, right? I don't want to be like this. I don't want to be like Grandpa Will. I don't want my whole life to be this obsession with the past, with tradition. Well, that is introduced to us again immediately when she walks into this kitchen and Gittel starts calling her Chaya, right? And here comes Shmuel across the field singing his song, and she's wondering what is going on. And Yolan writes for us, Hannah watched silently, trying to take it all in. How could she be both Hannah and this Chaya whose parents had died of a mysterious disease? She knew she was Hannah. She knew because she remembered. She remembered her mother and her father and her brother Aaron with his big blue eyes and great smile. She remembered her house with the jungle gym in the backyard and 17 stuffed dogs on her bed. She remembered her best friend Rosemary, who'd had braces the year before she did and had showed her how to eat jelly beans with them on, even though you weren't supposed to. She remembered her school in New Rochelle. As she remembered, she forgot to be a good sport, and her eyes began to fill with tears. Okay, so let's talk about this for just a second. What exactly is it that she is doing in this scene? She's just been transported to this brand new place, right? All of a sudden, here she is. She still thinks it's a prank, right? She hasn't accepted that this is a physical thing that's happened to her, right? That this is actually what's gone down. But she's still in a position where she thinks it's a prank. And what's she doing? Someone's calling her Chaya. What is it that she's trying to do in this remembering?
Yeah, Sam, good. She's trying to remember herself.
Exactly. As Amy says in the chat box, suddenly remembering is important to Hannah, right? Why is it important? What do you guys think? Why is it important?
Well, she needs to know who she is, right?
Exactly. It's important because all of a sudden, she is in a world that is attacking her knowledge of herself. She doesn't know who she is anymore because everything around her is trying to tear her down and tear her to pieces and destroy her identity. Does this remind you of anyone else in the story? Will. That's right, Maeve. Grandpa Will. So I just want to point out, as we start the second section of the story, this question of remembering, the question of identity, has been introduced in a really strong way. And the character that is walking alongside of Hannah, in our minds, as readers, is Grandpa Will and Aunt Eva, right? Who are living in a world that has tried to destroy them, literally. And what they fall back on, their defense, in that moment, is this remembering. For Grandpa Will and for Aunt Eva, the defense is remembering tribulations, right? Remembering the suffering that the Hebrews have been through at the hands of the Egyptians, right? The Passover dinner remembers that suffering and remembers the corresponding deliverance of God, right? By remembering the Passover, Grandpa Will and Aunt Eva are striving to maintain their own sense of who they are, particularly in the eyes of God, right? So this is where Hannah is sitting right now. She remembers all the things she can about her life. She remembers the braces on her friend. She remembers her stuffed dog. She remembers her parents. She remembers New Rochelle. Remembering, this is her ally in this situation. What do you think, Mrs. Andrews?
Yeah, absolutely. But this all gets a little fuzzy for her as she experiences life in this new world. Can someone tell us what is happening immediately when she gets dropped into this world? Maeve, we haven't heard from you today. Can you tell us what is happening in this Polish village?
Well, there's going to be a wedding. I don't remember exactly. It was just one of the relatives, one of Haya, I can't say her name, I'm sorry. But the relatives, I guess it's just a friend that was getting married to, I think it was Shmuel. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But there was going to be a wedding.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yep, so her uncle, or at least in this new world, her uncle, Shmuel, And I can't say the names either. Maybe we're just doing our best here.
Yeah, we all just try. It's Yiddish. Yiddish is a notoriously difficult language. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. But he's getting married to actually the rabbi's daughter, right?
That's right. Fega?
Beige. I think isn't there a yogurt name?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
That's no reason. Idea.
So there's a wedding taking place.
Okay, guys, we're going to do it again, okay? What is the thing about this wedding? Did this wedding strike you as strange to anybody else? But the celebration's a little bit weird. How come? Why were they weird? Amy says, no, not really. Okay, Amy, fair enough. There are chickens, says Caleb. Good. Yeah, there are chickens. It's very different. It's very different from a wedding that we might think about. The main reason for that is because, you guessed it, there are a whole host of traditions associated with weddings, aren't there?
One of my favorite parts is when she's trying to tell her new friends. By the way, we should talk about who she is in this new world, who she finds herself to be, because she's not herself. But she makes all these new friends and she's telling them stories and she tells them about all the movies she's seen and The Wizard of Oz and some fairy stories. And then she tells them the story of Fiddler on the Roof. And that's the only one where they're like, oh, yeah, we get that one. Yeah, we get that one.
We totally get Fiddler on the Roof.
Tradition.
Oh, my goodness. Mrs. Andrews just sung on the air. That was awesome.
So anyway, let's back up a little bit. Who is Chaya?
Yeah, who is this Chaya?
And why is she with her aunt and uncle? Sarah, go ahead.
She used to live in Lublin, probably a big city somewhere in Poland, but her parents died from a sickness, so she came to live with her aunt and uncle.
Okay, good. And not just that, but how do they explain the weird things that Hannah says?
Because she had gotten sick too, and I think had barely survived. So they thought that something like weird had happened to her.
Okay, awesome. That's great. Thank you, Sarah. Right. Okay, so she was in Lublin, and her parents die of an illness. And so her aunt Gittel and her uncle Shmuel take her in, and she apparently has had this terrible fever for a long time. And this is how they explain away all the kind of crazy things, the unsynchronous things that she is saying.
Which, as one of our students put it in the last class, is kind of lucky because she's saying some weird stuff. Everybody might think she's a little crazy if it weren't for the fact that she's supposed to have just recovered from a fever. Okay, good. So now, in this beginning of the story, before the next major moment of rising action, which I think is fairly obvious when the Nazis show up at the door of the church and take all the people away, right, to the cattle cars. I think I want to ask that question that I told you we were going to ask over and over again. What is it that Hannah wants, or Chaya at this point? What does she want? Is it different from what she wanted in this first scene? Okay, people to believe her. Good, Sam. To warn them. Good, Maeve. We're going to get there in just a second. How is that different from what she wanted in the first scene? Jeremy, she wants to remember. Good, Jeremy. Can we sum it up with she wants to go home? She wants to get back to her own time. She wants to remember. And in her efforts to remember, in her desire to go home, what does she do with these little girls that she's met? What is she constantly doing? She's telling stories, isn't she? What kind of stories? Good, Maeve. What sort of stories is she telling them? Telling them stories about home. Right? Telling them stories, well, in this sense, it's about the future, which is kind of funny, right? Stories from her life back home in New Rochelle. Okay, so storytelling. That's interesting. Isn't that a species of what's going on in the first scene at the Passover Seder? Aren't all those traditions involved in that Passover dinner telling that story? So again, we've got an instance in which she is being changed by her circumstances. In the beginning, she wanted to do anything but remember. I don't want to remember. Now, being faced with this question, am I Chaya, right? Am I Hannah, or who exactly am I? She's clinging to these memories as desperately as possible.
Well, and she's telling stories about herself. She just can't see the connection, right? Because that's what they're doing at the Passover. They're telling stories about themselves. Maybe not lives that they personally have lived, but it factors into their identity in their minds about who they are. That's all Hannah is doing, is trying to tell her friends about who she is.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. So we're 46 minutes into class, and we haven't even started the concentration camp bit of our discussion yet. And so I'm just going to give us the same sort of disclaimer I usually give us about this. That if we had weeks to go through this book, we could discuss every tiny scene. And Jane Yolen is so good that every moment of this story has some important thing to tell us. But if we're going to make it all the way to the end of the book, we can't discuss every single scene. So let's be choosy about where we spend our time over the course of the rest of the class. But I want to go back to one comment that I think Maeve made. Let's see here. Yeah, Maeve said she wants to warn them, right? Her new friends. She wants to warn them. This is obviously tied to our next moment of rising action, where the Nazis show up at the door of the church and bar their entry and put them all on the trains. What is it that Hannah is trying to do throughout this whole scene as they're arriving at the concentration camp?
Why is she trying to warn them?
So they can escape before it's too late. Good, Amy. She's trying to warn them because... Yes, exactly, Jeremy. Took the words right out of my mouth. She is trying to change the past. She knows what's going to happen. And now that she's standing there, she desperately wants to change things. Right? And the response that she gets is not something that she expects, is it? I'm going to read you this section. Those men down there, she cried out desperately. They're not wedding guests. They're Nazis. Nazis, do you understand? They kill people. They will kill Jews. Hundreds of them. Thousands of them. 6 million of them. I know. Don't ask me how I know. I just do. We have to turn the wagons around. We have to run. Rep Boruk shook his head. There are not 6 million Jews in all of Poland, my child. No, Rabbi, 6 million in Poland and Germany and Holland and France and, my child, such a number. He shook his head and smiled, but the corners of his mouth turned down instead of up. And as for running, where would we run to? God is everywhere. There will always be Nazis among us. No, my child, do not tremble before mere men. It is God before whom we must tremble. Only God. We will go ahead, just as we have planned. After all, this is our shtetl, not theirs, and there is still a wedding to be made.
So Hannah sees herself in a position of being able to teach them, right? I'm from the future. I have knowledge. I have facts, information that will be useful to you. Let me tell you about this. Instead, I think the rabbi has something to teach her.
Yeah, what does he say?
He may not have the facts, but he understands something.
Well, and he understands it for a particular reason. What What is it that he understands? What does he say to her in this scene, you guys? Can somebody sum it up for me? What is he trying to tell Hannah, or Chaya, as he thinks, in this scene? Anybody remember? Can anybody sum it up for me? What is the thrust of what he's trying to say? Good, Jeremy. Do not be afraid, but why? Okay, Amy, because God is here. Don't be afraid of men because God is here. That's good, except the history of the Hebrews isn't that God is going to protect them from horrible things happening, is it? It's just that God is everywhere and that God is. And so what does the Reb advise Hannah to do? What does he tell them he's going to do? Well, just move forward, right? He's just going to do the next thing. There will always be Nazis. Where would we run to? We can't run from God. Now, where is he getting this information? How does he know? Well, it's not from the future, is it? He's getting it from the past. He's getting it from his tradition, from his cultural memory of the way God interacts with his people. So, in this scene now, what does Hannah want? She wants to change things, right? She wants to use her knowledge of the future to write a different story. And what is she faced with? Someone who tells her that is not how we live. We don't live by using what we know to change the future. We live by looking back into the past. For the character of God, right? We look back into the past because God is. And right. We look back to see what God does. And we trust God and walk forward.
So I would say that from Hannah's perspective, she wants to change things, right? She wants to... Another thing that we haven't really talked about is that she wants to go home. She wants to go back to who she remembers herself being in the past. Also kind of altering her circumstances. And my first instinct would be to say that she is up against fate, right? She wants to change her own fate, and she wants to change the fate of the Jewish people in this moment. But what the Reb here is saying is that actually this is a matter of God. This is up to God. Not up to us changing our fate, or not up to fate itself. We are in God's hands in this moment. And he is the one crafting our future.
Good. Amy, you asked a question in the chat box. You said, is that true? What exactly do you mean? Send us a note in the chat box. Let's see if I can answer your question. Okay, so there are so many moments of rising action, it's hard to know where to jump to next. I think I'll just get us to the concentration camp by saying that the hysteria mounts, right, in the cattle car and everything, and the attitudes of the people around Hannah get more and more dark and difficult as things go along. The first time that happens is when they start to see the belongings of their friends laying alongside the railroad tracks. The Nazis told them they would be able to take all of their things with them, and that they would have everything they needed, and that they were just being relocated. But when they begin to find the belongings of their loved ones on the side of the railroad tracks, it becomes clear that he was lying, and so they begin to be afraid. And then they are not let out of the cattle cars for days, and people begin to die. Begin to suffocate, begin to die of thirst. Obviously, everyone standing in one place for that long presents some problems with using the bathroom and things of that nature. The cattle car is a pretty hellish experience. And then they arrive at the concentration camp. What does Hannah want at this point? Is she still trying to change things? Maeve says no. Maeve, do you care to raise your hand and tell us why you think that?
I think that she realizes, I think she realizes that she can't really do anything anymore because they're now in the hands of the Nazis, and now they're, when they arrive at the concentration camp, she realizes, like, this is happening, I'm just going to have to do something against it instead of just keep trying to prevent it. And so I think she realizes that this is happening, she's going to have to go with it, and she realizes that, like, it's real. It's she can't really hold on to that lingering hope that it was a dream or that it was made up, because like this concentration camp is so real now, and she's now not picturing herself from the future. She's picturing herself as from here, remembering the future, I think. And yeah. She realizes that that's it. That's the future was the future, and now she's in the past.
Right.
Yeah.
Good. Good. That's a great answer. I just want to weave together some of the things that we've been talking about the whole class at this point. Because if we watch that question, right, what does Hannah want? Change over the course of the story. What we're seeing is this really interesting shift. In the beginning of the story, she says, I don't want to remember, right? And we've talked about how that's an identity question and about how she's watching her relatives live in the past instead of the future. And she wants to live in the present, right? She wants to live now and moving forward rather than looking backwards all the time. And then she is transported to this other time and she wants to go home. And this emphasis on remembering begins to happen. By the middle of the story, by this concentration camp time, her attention is focused on the present, right? She's been forced to live in the present. And I think this is symbolized by the fact that, like James says in the chat box, she forgets who Hannah is. She can no longer remember, except as a dim sort of dream, who it is that she was supposed to be. She even questions whether she actually is Hannah or if she really truly has been Kaya all along. Maybe she has just been in this feverish dream, right? And she wakes up and finds that New Rochelle was an imaginary place, and all these movies that she's seen, her family, all that stuff was imaginary. And really, she's Kaya, right? There's a sense in which she's being forced to just live. And what she wants now in this middle of the story is to live. She's focused, as everyone in the concentration camp is, on just getting to the next day. What do you think, Mrs. Andrews?
Yeah, and not just that, but I'm thinking of the part where she consciously tells herself that maybe talking about this with everyone, maybe trying to tell them about what's going to happen isn't worth it. Maybe it's better to not know. Maybe I need to keep this to myself. Are you trying to find that passage?
Yeah, I am.
What do you guys think? Is it better to know or to not know? What side of that issue do you fall on?
Here, let me read you that section, because I think it's really interesting. Hannah was furious. They had to listen. She would have to make them. What use was her special foreknowledge if no one would listen? Maybe they thought her strange or sick or even crazy, but she was none of that. She was from the future, somehow. She could summon up those memories by trying really hard. She knew she could help them all, if only they would let her. Then she looked up. The women and the other girls were shyly, painfully, slowly taking off their clothes. Hannah thought they looked so vulnerable, so helpless. Yet they had a kind of innocence about them, and a kind of hope. And they were looking forward to what they were looking forward to was the shower. Biting her lower lip, she thought what her knowledge of the ovens, of the brutal guards, of names like Auschwitz and Dachau could really do for them here, naked and weaponless, except to take away that moment by moment of hope. Maybe Gethel was right. We are where we are. She would not add more to their misery. She bent over and untied her shoes.
When I think about this, I think that maybe the question isn't quite right to know or to not know. That maybe we need to remember what the rabbi said. Anna knows some facts. She knows the names of Auschwitz and Dachau. She knows the statistics of what happens. But the kind of hope that Gittel and the other women are holding on to is not a hope that looks forward, kind of like we were talking about it. It's not a hope that looks forward to what's going to happen in the future so much as it looks into the past and remembers that the story of the Israelites is one of exile and return, right? They're always put in a place of suffering, and God always comes through and redeems them. He's always there and taking care of them. It's a hope that relies on that knowledge that even though we're suffering now, there will be a reconciliation.
Yeah, well said, Mrs. Andrews. I think it's really interesting that it's directly after that realization that when she says, I won't add to their sorrow, it's directly after that that she can't remember anymore, right? She's getting her hair cut. And all of a sudden, she realizes, with sudden awful panic, she could no longer recall anything from the past. I cannot remember, she whispered to herself. I cannot remember. She'd been shorn of memory, as brutally as she'd been shorn of her hair, without permission, without reason. Opening her eyes, she stared at the floor. Clots of wet hair lay all about. Dark hair, light hair, short hair, long hair, and two pale braids. Gone. All gone, she thought again, wildly, no longer even sure what was gone, what she was mourning. So it's in that moment when she decides, I'm not going to bring this up anymore. I'm not going to add to their misery by taking away that moment by moment of hope. That's when she loses her memory. When she becomes, if you think about it for a second, she becomes one with the rest of the people in the room, when she joins them in their suffering, right? But also, it's important, I think, to note what Yolen says there, that moment by moment of hope, right? She joins them also in their hope. Is that something that we've seen from Hannah in the story so far? Have we seen hope from her?
Well, I think she's been pretty removed from the circumstances up until this moment. She's kind of looking at it as a history student, someone who sat in class and read about these things. But here she's actually, her hair, her own hair, has been taken from her. Mm-hmm. She is given a number in exchange for a name.
Yeah, exactly. So now she lives in the present. Now she must live in the present. She has no options but to live where she is. And all she wants to do now is survive.
But speaking of survival, who does she meet in the camp? There are some new characters that enter the scene, right? What is life in the camp like? Yeah, Lauren, Rivka. Who's Rivka?
Her Aunt Eva, right? But we don't know that until the end, right? That's the resolution of the story. Who is she in the concentration camp when she meets her as Rivka?
Someone want to raise their hand and describe Rivka to us? Sarah, go ahead.
She had been at the concentration camp for, I think, a year. And she had learned how to survive there. So she passed on that some of the things that she had learned to Hannah and her friends to help them survive.
Yeah, good.
One of the things I think is really interesting about Rivka is that she's so young, right? She's 10 years old. 10. Hannah's older than she is. Okay, what is Hannah 12, Mrs. Andrews? Is that right?
I think so.
And Ken is 12 13, years old. 12. But Rivka doesn't seem young, does she? No, she seems aware and mature. She has experience that no one else has. And has that experience made her angry?
Well, where did she learn all the stuff that she does from in the first place? It's because her mother, right? Mm-hmm. She did these things with her mother. Right. But her mother dies. And instead of being bitter about this fact, she takes up her mother's work. And we get examples of other girls who kind of turn inward, right? And you can understand why. When things are this hard, when it's this hard for just finding basics and necessities, it's really easy to just turn inward and take care of yourself. But Rivka has instead turned outward, and she helps others.
So even though she's not as old as Kaya, who's 13 years old, Rivka is one who has knowledge and understanding that Kaya and her friends don't have yet. I think it's really interesting that Mrs. Andrews points out what she's done is taken up her mother's mantle, which means work, right? She's taken up her mother's work, which is, as you guys remember, probably organizing, quote-unquote, things, right? Using the rules of the camp, rather than trying to break them, using the rules of the camp to make life a little bit more bearable for everyone else there, right? She organizes things. She steals stuff and repurposes it. She stocks the medicine cabinet of one of the ladies in the camp by organizing things, right? So she's got this hopeful outlook, even though she knows where she is. She's not stupid or childish. It isn't that she doesn't know what's happening here in this camp. She knows where people are going. She knows that the ovens exist. In fact, her brother, whom we later find out is Grandpa Will, her brother is one of the people running the ovens. He's being forced to brutally murder his own people. But despite all of this, she has a sunny personality, doesn't she? One of the things I think is interesting is that the camp has a motto. Anybody remember what the camp motto is? Anyone? What's the camp motto?
You don't have to use the German. You can give an English paraphrase. Yeah, Amy, work makes you free.
Work makes you free. Work makes you free. Has work made Rivka free?
In some ways, I think so.
I think it has too. That's not what they meant by it, right?
No.
That's not what the Germans meant by this.
Right, because they're thinking individuals, right? Work for yourself. Work to stay alive.
Well, and it's also a lie, right? You come here and you work and then we'll set you free, which they don't ever intend to do.
Or at least by death.
Right. What I think is interesting is that the personality and the ability of all of these camp inmates to maintain their identity, even in the face of all of this suffering and persecution, they've maintained their identity. They're still being who they are. That allows them to take that motto itself and give it their own meaning, right? By taking care of the people around her, by caring for her fellow sufferers, Rivka has given her life meaning, a meaning that is beyond trying to stay alive. Instead, the meaning to her life is keeping other people alive. That's what her mother did. That's now what she is doing. So this identity that Rivka has is, I think, attractive to Hannah, isn't it, Mrs. Andrews?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So I think we're at the point in the class where I'd like to ask you guys, where's the climax of the story? Our conflicts are pretty well described at this point, right? We've got a man versus self conflict. Who is Hannah, right? Is she Hannah or is she Kaya? We've got the obvious man versus man conflict, right? Is she going to live or die? Are the Germans going to kill her, or is she going to survive the concentration camp? And then I think we've got a larger question of remembering. Will Hannah remember? Which I think we can sort of sum up as, will Hannah actually understand who she is when it comes to her heritage, to her family? So where's the climax of the story?
Okay, good. Lauren says when she dies, Jeremy says when she sacrifices herself for her friends. Can anyone kind of describe how that, what is happening? Because, I mean, we know that it's getting to be the end of the years of the war. There's too many people in the camp. And so when new trains arrive with Jews, they're not even given the opportunity to work anymore. They're taken straight to the ovens. By the way, let's talk about the language that the Germans use here for a second. They don't call it death. They don't call it killing. They call it being chosen or being processed. What is the effect of this kind of sterilized language? Why do they use it? Why don't they call it what it is? Any ideas? Why not just call it what it is?
Caleb says to hide the truth slightly.
Yeah, I think so. I think that has something to do with it. I think it ties into this whole question of remembering, too. They are using this slightly clean, slightly distanced language. They're distancing themselves from what they're doing, so that they are remembering themselves in a particular way.
Yeah, right? I agree. I think that the language there, the impulse of the language there, is to, as Caleb said, avoid admitting out loud that what they're doing is wrong, right? This is just a big machine, right? And the machine runs a particular way, and the individuals in this machine aren't individuals. They're pawns, right? They're a workforce. They're animals. They're not people. So you're not killed. You're selected. You're processed.
Right. Whereas the Jews have a heritage that is sacred. They remember themselves as human beings made in the image of God. The Germans are remembering themselves as a machine. I think that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. As a machine.
If you use and it's a different technical kind of terms, it doesn't, it's not human life. It doesn't matter.
Right. Exactly.
It's a different kind of what? I'm sorry.
Not important. So the climax of the story.
I'm sorry. I was in the middle of talking about how they've run out of room. They're processing all the new trains that arrive. And the other thing that happens is when the commandant comes, he starts selecting Jews who aren't working to be processed. And he discovers Rivka and Hannah and their friends not working. Why? Why aren't they working? What happens? Evelyn, go ahead.
Hannah was telling them all a story to lift their spirits.
Yeah. There she goes with her stories again. And then what happens? He finds them.
And then he says that three of them are going to be selected.
Okay, good. So he selects them. But not Hannah, right? He chooses everyone except for Hannah, kind of arbitrarily.
what does Hannah do? What does she want in this particular moment?
I mean, first of all, it's kind of her fault, right? She was telling a story. She was distracting everyone. And she's the reason they get caught.
Good, James. She wants to save her friends. Okay, so let's chart the shift here. In the beginning of the story, she doesn't want to remember. Then she's taken away from her home, and all of a sudden she does want to remember. She wants to live in the past again because she wants to remember who she is. Then the Nazis show up, and she begins to want to change things, right? She's being forced to live in the present until finally she's at the concentration camp, and all she's trying to do is survive, right? She just wants to live now. Now what does she want more than living?
Her friends to live.
She wants her friends to live. So what does she do? Who wants to narrate this section of the story for us? Caleb, go ahead. Mrs. Andrews, do you want to unmute?
So, it's a new soldier who picks them, isn't it? Not the commandant.
Yes.
Because three women go off with him, and then Hannah goes up to Rivka, I think, and says, "Here, give me your bandana, and I'll put it on. He won't know the difference because he's new." So then she goes instead of Rivka.
Good. So she takes on the identity of Rivka in disguise so that the soldier will take her and not her friend. And she tells Rivka on their way, being taken away, what are the final moments here? You have that part, Mr. Andrews.
Working on it.
She told her to remember, right? To remember what has just happened. To remember them. To keep them alive in her memory. To tell the story to other people. Yeah, Peyton, and to run and to save herself. And so Rivka is spared. And what does Hannah do as her and her three friends are taken to the ovens? She tries to comfort them. How?
Good, Caleb. She tells a story.
Yeah. What about what?
Good, Sarah. She tells a story about the future of the Jews. The future in New Rochelle. She tells them a story about herself. Her memories begin to come back. It's about a girl, an ordinary sort of girl named Hannah Stern, who lives in New Rochelle. Not Old Rochelle. There is no Old Rochelle, you see. Just New Rochelle. It is in an America where pictures come across a cable, moving pictures right into your living room. She stopped as the dark door into Lilith's cave opened before them. And where one day, I bet, a Jewish girl will be president if she wants to be. Are you ready now? Ready or not, here we come. Then all three of them took deep, ragged breaths and walked in through the door into endless night.
Not only do I think this is a climax, because Hannah clearly shows that she has changed here, that she is thinking about others instead of herself, but also she spends her final moments remembering herself in context with a greater narrative.
Good. So then what happens? She's just laid down her life for her friends. That's clearly the climax of the story. What happens next? Caleb, your hand is up. Go ahead.
Oh, is it? So she's transported back to the living room that she was first in, and everyone's asking her, like, oh, where was the piece of fabric? So she's right back at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, we're right back at the moment where she is opening the door for Elijah, right? So she comes through the door that Elijah is supposed to come through.
Right. So there's also, this is so fun. There's so much imagery in this last scene, right? So she finds herself back in the hallway outside of 4N, her apartment in New Rochelle, right? And she says, 4, the number of people in my family, N for New Rochelle, right? Because she's developed a habit, hasn't she? She's developed a habit of looking at all of these details, all the details that fill up her life and finding meaning in them, right? Just like the meaning of those numbers on her arm. And then she, as Mrs. Andrews says, the old man at the head of the table says, well, Hannah, is he coming? Hannah turned back and looked down the long, dark hall. It was still empty. There's no one there, she whispered. No one. So she's coping with the fact now that all of a sudden she's back home.
When she thought she was going to die.
Yeah, she thought she was going to die. Sam, don't hurry the child so. She's doing her part. The woman who spoke had a plain face lit up by a special smile. Come, sweetheart, sit by Aunt Eva. She patted an empty chair next to her, then reached over and picked up her glass of wine. You look so white, Hannah, like death. How can we fix that? She raised her glass, looked at Hannah. L'chaim, to life. She took a sip. Okay, so what do we know about Hannah's name, Chaya? What does Chaya mean? Life. Good, James. Chaya means life. Now, there was a scene when she first arrived at the concentration camp. You guys remember that scene? She's being ushered into a room where they're going to give them clothes to wear, right? They've just had showers, and they're going to take them in to give them clothes. And there's a man who's supervising handing out the clothes. He says, next. The man meant Hannah. She walked up to the table and sat down on a chair by the side of the table. Tell me your name, the man said. I'll give you a number in exchange. That seemed simple enough, but she couldn't think of a name. There was none that came to her. From behind, Gittel whispered hoarsely, Chaya, Chaya. She said it aloud, Chaya. It felt, and it did not feel, like hers. The man looked at her, and his eyes were the saddest she'd ever seen, a muddy brown like river sludge. His mouth was puckered and old. It dropped open as easily as a slot in a machine, and a sound, not quite a cry, came out. I knew it would come, he whispered. Someday. The Malak Hamavis. What? What? Hannah asked. That is my daughter's dress you're wearing, Chaya Abramovich. My Chaya. I bought it as a present for her in Lublin. Chaya, Hannah said. The same name, too. God is good. Your name means life. Life, Hannah repeated. He nodded, then shook his head, the one following the other, like a single movement. You are Chaya no longer, child. Now you are J197241. Remember it. I can't remember anything, Hannah said, puzzled. Well, this you must remember, for if you forget it, life is gone indeed. When the man finished the number, he reached out and touched the collar of her dress, smoothing it down gently. Live, he whispered, for my Chaya, for all our Chayas, live and remember. So what do we see in this scene, you guys? May, if your hand is up, go ahead. You may need to unmute yourself on your end, Maeve. Oh, no worries. I think what we see in this scene is sort of an image of what this name is supposed to mean to us, right? As readers, there's a thematic meaning to this name, this Chaya, right? Her Jewish name and the name of this little girl that she, whose life she lives here for a minute at the concentration camp. And we're told over and over again, it means life, right? When this man sees her, what he sees is his daughter. And the reason he knows, by the way, just to make it clear, the reason he knows his daughter is dead is because Chaya is wearing her dress. And since she's wearing her dress, the girl that was wearing it before no longer owns it, which means she's been processed. But this man's response to that isn't to fly off the handle and be angry and be bitter. His response is to say, God is good. Why might that be? Why is he saying God is good in that scene? Because hope, right, James? He's saying God is good, first of all, on a technical level. He's saying God is good because his daughter is no longer suffering, right? She's dead. She's no longer in the camp. She's been taken home. But secondly, he's saying God is good because that is what one does when one is suffering, right? And this little girl's name, this little girl that God has sent to him as a symbol that the angel of death, the Malach HaMavis, has harvested his daughter, right? The angel of death has come along. The angel of death, by the way, you guys, in this story and in all stories, the angel of death is a servant of God, right? It's not Satan that sends the angel of death on the Egyptians. It's God. It's the Lord. It's the God of the Hebrews. So when they look down this long tunnel into the ovens, what do they say, Emily, Mrs. Andrews? What do they say? Malach HaMavis, right? The angel of death. That's what they call this. That's what they call it when one of these Jews is killed in the concentration camps. Are they attributing all of the horrible things that are happening to them to the devil?
Well, it's a release, right? Because of their heritage, because of the stories they've been told, they believe that the angel of death brings them into the presence of God, right? And that there is life at the end of earthly life.
Good. So at the end of this story, at the end of this difficult, heavy story, she arrives back at home, sits down next to her aunt, who says, L'chaim, right? To life. Aunt Eva turned toward her, smiling. Her sweater was pushed back beyond her wrist. As she raised the glass again, Hannah noticed the number on her arm, J18202, which you guys remember is Rivka's number. Hannah, you're staring, whispered Aunt Eva as the talk began around the table. Uncle Sam arguing about the price of new cars, Grandpa Will complaining about the latest government scandal, her mother asking Aunt Rose about a book. Staring, she repeated, without understanding. Yes, at my arm, at the number. Does it frighten you still? You've never let me explain it to you, and your mother hates me to talk of it. Still, if you want me to. Hannah touched the number on her aunt's arm with surprising gentleness, whispering, No, no, please, let me explain it to you. For a moment she was silent. Then she said, J is for Jew, and one because you were alone, alone of the eight who had been in your family, though two was the actual number of them alive. Your brother was a commando, one of the Jews forced to tend the ovens, to handle the dead, so he thought he was a zero. She looked up at Eva, who was staring at her. Oh, your brother. Grandpa Will. That must have been him carrying Fag, or whatever her name is. So that's why. Aunt Eva closed her eyes for a moment, as if thinking or remembering. Then she whispered back, his name was Wolf. Wolf. And the irony of it was that he was gentle as a lamb. He changed his name when we came to America. We all changed our names. To forget. Remembering was too painful, but to forget was impossible. Her coffee brown eyes opened again. Go on, child. Hannah took her hand from her aunt's arm and dropped it into the safety of her own lap. She couldn't look at her aunt anymore. That familiar, unfamiliar, plain, beautiful face. You said, she whispered. You said that when things were over, you would be two again forever. J18202. They sat for a long moment in silence while the talk and laughter at the table dipped and soared about them like swallows. At last, Hannah looked up. Her aunt was staring at her, as if really seeing her for the first time. Aunt Eva, Hannah began, and Eva's hand touched her on the lips, firmly, as if to stop her mouth from saying what had to be said. "In my village, in the camp, in the past," Eva said, "I was called Rivka." Hannah nodded and took her aunt's fingers from her lips. She said in a voice much louder than she had intended, so loud that the entire table hushed at its sound, "I remember. Oh, I remember." So what does Hannah want in this scene?
She remembers her aunt, right? For the first time, she has the tools to really remember her aunt. And in return, she calls Aunt Eva into a remembrance of herself and to her friend Naya. They remember each other. And it's through this remembrance that real relationship is able to take place. I think it's an interesting image. We talked a little bit about the tradition of Elijah coming through the door at the beginning of class. But here at the end, Hannah goes through this entire experience, and she is the one who comes through the door, and she sits in the chair left for Elijah. And if Elijah is meant to be this image of redemption or salvation, in what ways could Hannah be that? Why does Yolin give us this image of Hannah taking on the position of the prophet Elijah? In what way is she hope now? Any ideas? What is this image doing? Well, for one, isn't it interesting that Hannah is so good at telling stories? She's been given a gift as a storyteller. And through most of the story, the stories that she recalls are good ones. They're fun ones that she entertains her friends with. But now she has a new story to tell other people. And it's through that telling of that story that she, the story of her aunt, the story of those who were lost. There's a passage in the story where it talks about the only way to keep alive the memory of those who are gone is by keeping them in ourselves. Their memory is alive in us. Hannah is able to keep that life alive, to pass it on to other people. And in a way that redeems what happened. They are kept alive in the midst of death. What do you think, Mr. Andrews?
I think it's beautiful. I love this story. Here's the thing, and let's talk about, I mean, we've been talking about theme now for a minute, but let's go ahead and put a sentence or a definition on our theme of the story. I would like to suggest that the theme of the story is remembering, obviously, but with an emphasis on the power of memory to give one an identity. In particular, let's talk about identity this way. What about if identity, if personhood, is something that is defined by one's relationships, right? By one's relationships with one another, with one's family, with one's God, right? Identity is something I think that does come from those relationships. And what we watch over the course of this story is Hannah coming to a deep and abiding understanding of that, right? She is a child of a very, very rich cultural heritage, and also the child of a rich family heritage. of a family heritage that is acquainted with suffering, that's acquainted with sorrow, but is also acquainted with the power of God to deliver someone from that suffering and from that sorrow. Her grandpa Will and her aunt Eva remember being in the concentration camps themselves. They were there. And because of that, their perspective on suffering is so deep. Can you imagine how somebody like that would respond to you if you were in trouble? Would they look at you and they would say, you don't understand, you're not in trouble? No, they wouldn't, because there's compassion in their hearts, right? Aunt Eva is kind. She's kind and she's gentle, and it's because of those experiences. It's because she's undergone suffering and she understands it, right? That's what Hannah says at the end. I remember, right? I understand. I was there. I can describe your suffering because I was there. So what I want to suggest to you is that the theme of this story is memory having the power to help us relate to one another. We identify with one another in specifically our suffering.
But what about for those of us who can't do what Hannah did? We don't actually get transported to another world. How do we remember? We've read a lot of stories. Sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder. Okay. Sorry. I'll let you chime in. We've read a lot of stories this year, and the one that we have read for today is actually historical, right? Through reading this story about what happened in the Holocaust, we remember and we honor the memory of those who suffered at that time. But what about the other stories that we've read this year? Henry V, The Merchant of Venice, Fellowship of the Ring.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'd like to suggest is that Hannah spends the entire book learning the story of her particular cultural heritage, right? Hannah learns the story of what it means to be a Jew, to be an American Jew after the Holocaust has taken place. And she is brought into her own cultural heritage and given her own identity by learning that story. But the rest of us, by reading that, are being brought into the same tradition, not in ourselves as Jews, right, as Hebrews ourselves, but instead as people, right, who are engaging in the suffering that Hannah has to undergo, that her family has to undergo. I think that reading any story does that. Reading a story well is learning how to engage with being a person, with being a human being. Great authors write for the purpose of talking about being a person.
Well, right. We may not be, when we read The Fellowship of the Ring, we may not be remembering actual historical events that happened, but we remember what it means to be too weak and to need someone else to help us along the way. We remember what it means to be a human. And through that memory, we can relate to others better. We can have relationships with them. We understand. We have compassion for each other. And we understand ourselves. We have compassion for ourselves and what it means to be a human in this world and how we relate to each other and how we relate to God. That's what we've been trying to do this year.
That's what we hope to teach you guys how to do with every work of literature. As we read along, looking for themes, what we're doing, if you stop and think about it for a second, is relating to a person. Every book has an author, and the author set out to say something really particular. Jane Yolen set out to talk about the power of memory, right? Set out to talk about cultural identity, to talk about a little girl learning what it means to be a child of her family, learning what it means to be someone from the Jewish heritage, from the Hebrew culture. And I think it's a great book to end the year with, because we are trying to teach you guys to do exactly that. You all are children of cultures, right? You're children of an intellectual heritage. In reading English literature, we are all children of the West, of the intellectual tradition of the West. And that means a few things about the way that we think. There are ideas in that tradition that allow us to think the way all other human beings have thought for years and years and years and centuries and centuries. And by asking all of these questions that we've been asking you all along throughout this whole year, we've been trying to teach you how to participate in that conversation, how to sit down with a book, and how to see the author talking to you through the pages of that story, how to understand what he's saying to you, and how to add it to your own deep understanding of what it means to be a person. We're hoping to give you the tools to develop a deep and a compassionate understanding of the human condition by reading great literature. Because I think that's why great literature was written, to allow us all to participate in a broad community, a community that is as big as the world of literature. It's as varied as the many books that have been written about it.
Thanks for listening to this selection from the Center for Lit Academy Library. To explore other titles, visit us on the web at www.centerforlit.com.